I thank you for welcoming me here and my struggle in my life to get here. I want to tell you something personal about me. I've traveled here from Jersey City. I've been very ill since last summer. This is the first time I've been out of my house traveling. Thank you. While it's not life-threatening, something I didn't know last summer, it is a challenge for me physically to stand up here and speak. But I want you to know that what I lack in energy, I feel such a passion to be here, and I thank you so much for all the warmth that people have expressed to me since the moment I arrived. I want to know more about you, though. And so, without putting anyone on the spot, and out of respect and solidarity for the disabled activists who are here, rather than ask people to stand, I'm going to ask you to raise your hands. Raise your hand, please, if you face oppression as a woman. Raise your hand, please, if you face oppression because you are transsexual, transgender, intersex, lesbian, gay, or bisexual. If you're a partner, not just related to oppression, but living with it as queer family, please raise your hand. If you face discrimination for femininity, whether female or male, please raise your hand. If you are oppressed because of your nationality, your ethnicity, your religion, or your immigration status, and you feel comfortable on that last one to raise your hand, please do. If you face inaccessibility in society based on age discrimination, whether youth or elder, please raise your hand. Now, if you've raised your hand more than once, please raise your hand. I believe that the movement for women's liberation will be more powerful as we explore more deeply the connections between all of us who raised our hands tonight. And together with all of those who are listening to these broadcasts, who we know would be raising their hands if they were here, and with those who are struggling around the world, from Iraq to Haiti, from Palestine to Venezuela. I thank Women's Studies at SFU for letting me be part of this conference today, this exciting conference today, and congratulations on the 30th anniversary of Women's Studies. It's a big, big thing to celebrate. It's also a big thing for me to get to come to Canada. I have spent a lot of my life in Canada. I grew up in Buffalo. I could have walked across the so-called Peace Bridge. It was so close. And for the old gay community, which I don't just mean those of us who are getting hoary-headed here, but the pre-Stonewall community, the blue-collar, gay, lesbian, drag communities, we were sororal communities with those from St. Catharines and Toronto, and spent a great deal of our time in Canada. It was only during the Vietnam War when my gender queerness made crossing the bridge impossible, because when I would the first thing I would be asked is, where's your draft card? I was in Manitoba as a guest of the Two-Spirit Conference out in the woods under the rolling northern lights. In Quebec, as part of the anti-war and anti-globalization struggles. In Edmonton, and to where the prairies go from flat to beginning to roll up towards the Rocky Mountains. But until I flew over the volcanic ridge yesterday and saw the sun red on the mountains and set down beside the Pacific, I have never been in Vancouver before. And thank you for inviting me here to learn from your conference, from your movement, from your struggles here, and they're lessons that I'll take back to me with me. While there is no universal military draft yet in the U.S., just an economic draft at this point and extended tours that get extended and extended, my travel here across this border and returning home tomorrow through immigration in Chicago makes me a criminal. I'm a felon because this passport is issued to me as male and I am female bodied. I can talk more with you during the discussion about why, but I want to say to you that if I am detained in that no man's land of U.S. customs, and it is a no man's land, then I ask you to help me make a struggle out of this, because I say to the U.S. government, come and get me. Let's make a political struggle out of this and tell me why, on a passport that has the most sophisticated form of identification possible, a recent photo, I have to check off an either-or box and be virtually strip-searched by customs just to come here and connect with you. I live in Jersey City on the East Coast, across from Manhattan in the U.S. I don't use America because in the U.S., it's such a chauvinist term, because the assumption is that everyone in this hemisphere is not of the Americas, only those in the U.S. And tonight I want to focus on a couple of the historical lessons that we've had in the women's struggles in the U.S., not because of unexamined national chauvinism, but because I live in the belly of the beast, a beast making war domestically and carrying it around the world. My job is to bring the war home, to deepen understanding that my enemy is not in Baghdad or Gaza, Havana or Tehran, Damascus or Pyongyang or Caracas. It's in Washington, on Capitol Hill, and on Wall Street. And so it means a great deal to me here to be able to connect with you all about deepening our theoretical understanding of women's oppression and what it will take for liberation. Because if theory, I believe, is abstracted, if it is not a distillation of experience, then it ceases to become a guide for action. And the point, of course, of any studies, including women's studies, is not just to interpret the world, but to change it. The experience in the U.S. of the struggle for women's liberation, of course, predates what we call second wave feminism. There are many who have explored, perhaps not enough in the U.S., but have explored the relationship between the 19th century women's rights movement and the struggle to abolish the enslavement of African peoples. It was one of the greatest coalitions, if not the greatest, to date on the continent of what is now, in the country of what is now the United States. I believe we also need to explore the trans issues and gay issues that were part of that movement. To go back and restudy Sojourner Truth's challenge in her Ain't I a Woman speech, where she challenged white supremacy and the class bias of the social definition of what it meant to be a true woman, true womanhood. Sojourner Truth, who stood 6 feet tall, whose voice was described as rolling thunder, whose muscles rippled from a lifetime of forced enslaved labor. Sojourner Truth, who was forced to strip to the waist by white men who demanded to know if she was a man in women's clothing. In Seneca Falls, the convention in 1848, Frederick Douglass, the great orator, the great abolitionist, and one of the greatest advocates for women's rights that we have seen yet in the United States, was one of 31 men who attended that convention. He stood up and said something there that that we could march under as a banner today, he said from the podium that our doctrine is that right is of no sex. Frederick Douglass, the other 30 men at that convention, and any man who stood up for women's rights were gay baited and trans baited and intersexual baited. He was called a hermaphrodite, an Aunt Nancy's man, a women's rights man. Now that curse has lost its sting. Now if somebody said, what are you, a women's rights man? It's like, what? But at the time, it was a serious slur meant to emasculate a man who was only a few years out of enslavement himself. And Frederick Douglass demonstrated how to stand up to that kind of baiting. He came out publicly again and again, and he said, I am proud to be known as a women's rights man. And before his death, when he spoke to another conference of women, if I might be allowed to paraphrase, he said, when I ran away from slavery, escaped from slavery, it was for myself. When I advocated emancipation, it was for my people. But when I stood up for women's rights, the question of self was out of the question. And in doing so, I found a little nobility in the act. I believe that's the kind of nobility, the only kind of nobility, to which we should aspire, to be the best fighters against each other's oppression. After the Civil War, when the Democratic and Republican parties tried to tear asunder this powerful coalition by pitting the rights of black men to vote against the rights of white women to vote, Douglass appealed that lynch law was the law of the land. He appealed to white women to support the right of black men to vote and said he would work as hard as he could to bring about the vote for white women as well. It was the white women who stood with African American liberation who should be on the programming for March Women's History Month, and who should be on the coins instead of those like Susan B. Anthony who succumbed to white supremacy in order to defend the right of white women to vote against the right of black men to vote. And when the export of the southern plantations were sent to Cuba and the Philippines and Hawaii, as the expansion of capital, the beginning of this globalization under the cry of free trade, Teddy Roosevelt would exclaim that without war, we will become a nation of effeminate men. The transbaiting that became the birth of Rambo. In Germany in the late 19th and early 20th century, there was a powerful rising movement for gay and trans and lesbian liberation, and it connected with the rise of a women's rights movement as well. And it was a time when there was a powerful workers' movement with socialist leadership, and workers were electing socialists to parliament, and everyone knew World War I was coming. It wasn't a surprise. It was like when the U.S. media was saying, oh, you know, the invasion of Iraq is going to be in February, now the 15th, now the 20th. No, it's going to be March. But when the war began, those who were in parliament caved in and voted for the war credits. And so did many who were the leadership of the German homosexual emancipation movement. The notable exceptions were Rosa Luxemburg and Karl Liebknecht. And it derailed the movement. You know, you could almost imagine the leaders saying, well, gee, it's not really a gay issue, you know. And we're making such headway with the population, and we don't want to appear to be unpatriotic, you know. Can't we just go along with this war? Can't we just sit it out? Well, no, of course not. Because it meant that patriotism, social chauvinism, racism, jingoism began to roll like tank treads over the population. Those who were the most reactionary began to sit taller in the saddle, and those who were the most progressive or revolutionary began to be more isolated and pushed aside. War is a defining moment for any movement. If we can't stand up to a racist colonial war for empire, then what will our movements be able to stand up for? It wasn't until the 1917 Russian Revolution, which within weeks abolished the anti-homosexual laws and extended political and economic and social rights for women, that a new wind began to fill the sails of the movement in Germany as well with new leadership. And in November 1918, during the brief German Revolution, while the bullets were still whizzing overhead, the young revolution gave It's one of its first gifts to the German homosexual emancipation movement. Prince Hatzfeld's seized mansion, which was handed over to be the new archives of the sexual movement, liberation movement, and became maybe what we could call one of the first lesbian, gay, and trans community centers. And I know I'm leaving out bisexual, but it's because I specifically cannot find that inclusion, but it doesn't mean it did not exist, and I'm still looking. In the U.S., there are many who have heard, of course, about second wave feminism. You may think that all women, and particularly young women, have, but that's not true. If they have heard about it, they've heard the Rush Limbaugh attack on feminism as feminazis. Vicious. They've heard that they were the gender police. Or George Bush Sr.'s ghostwriter's formulation about political correctness, which the right wing has embraced, saying, why can't we just be so openly racist and male chauvinist pigs and always have to be looking over our shoulder nowadays? Why do we have to be so politically correct? Some have heard about the homophile movement at the height of McCarthyism in the 1950s. In the U.S. And if you just read about the homophile movement, you would think, how did it stand up to McCarthyism? How did it happen in the middle of what was the most reactionary period in U.S. history towards lesbians and gay men? A specific campaign in which not only anti-communist red baiting, but lavender menace gay baiting and mass purges from employment were at a frenzy. They looked to the establishment, to the experts, to say, tell us how to just fit in. Tell us how to adjust to oppression. Tell us how not to stand out. They had dress codes. They divorced themselves, quite literally, from the bar crowd, from those who were too butch if they were female and too femme if they were male. How did they do it? How did they organize in the middle of the 1950s? It was a time of a raging witch hunt because the U.S. rulers were enraged about having so-called lost China to a revolution. And the Korean War was underway. And if you spoke out about anything progressive, you could expect to find your name and address in the newspaper, be hounded, lose your job, have to move, have to go underground. It was a time after the war, the burgeoning war industry, which had drawn more women and more African Americans into big industry, and now suddenly Rosie the Riveter was being sent home where father knew best. But what has been left like a gap in collective consciousness, in social memory, because of the excising of the official histories of that period, is the tumultuous and militant struggles that were going on that objectively lifted up even the most moderate demands. For example, how many people here know that between 1950 and 1953, the first gay organizing on a political basis, publicly, based on the West Coast, was led by communist gays? One hand, two and three, four, out of all the people who are here. And that they went out to the gay beaches on the West Coast and got petitions signed to support the Korean people against the Pentagon war. And that they tried to link up this struggle in solidarity with African Americans, with Latinos, and the struggle against anti-Semitism. Daughters of Bilitis, the first national political lesbian rights organization, certainly not the first organizing of lesbians. No voices could have been lifted sweeter or clearer than those of the Harlem Renaissance. And the buffet parties and the rent parties were just as much political organizing and economic organizing. But this was on a national basis. It was largely white women, white collar, professional, middle class for the most part. How did they form in 1955? What gave these lesbians the idea in San Francisco that this was just the right political moment in history to sit down and organize? Well, here's another whiteout, whitewash from the official histories. The decade of militant red feminism from 1946 to the mid-50s, in which communist women, black and white, were out organizing, particularly in strength, on the West Coast in California. And they also helped lay a theoretical basis for the relationship of women's oppression to racism and to class oppression, and to fight for an understanding within the left movement that women's oppression is a critical frontline battle in the class war. And in 1955, that was the year that the civil rights movement accelerated. In the summer of 1955, before the Daughters of Bilitis formed, you could see black women, particularly working class women, in the leadership of a movement that was inspiring the downtrodden everywhere in the US and around the world. That was the summer that 14-year-old Emmett Till was dragged from the bed where he was visiting in Mississippi and lynched, the third lynching of an African-American male in the U.S. that year alone. His mother, Mamie Till Mobley, made a courageous decision in Chicago. She demanded that the casket be opened for his funeral. And 50,000 people lined the streets of Chicago to view his body, which was almost unrecognizable because of the mutilation by white supremacists. 100 days later, seamstress Rosa Parks refused to surrender her seat on a municipal bus in Birmingham to a white man who demanded it. She later told a reporter, "I kept thinking about Emmett Till. I couldn't get the photos out of my mind." After a 381-day bus boycott, it was like it lit the tinder of all the anti-lynching and all the anti-racist, anti-Jim Crow segregation organizing that was going on. After 381 days in which 40,000 African Americans refused to take the bus and walk to work, that hard-won battle just sent shockwaves through the country in terms of inspiring people that oppression could be fought. Lesbians and gay men of all nationalities, including whites, were part of the civil rights movement, supporting not just an end to racist apartheid, to segregation, but the aspirations and the ongoing struggle for national liberation, because the U.S. is like a prison house of nations. It's like domestic colonies, internal colonies under police occupation. And when the FBI tried to bust up the movement, to fracture the solidarity and break it up, they didn't just use red baiting, they used gay baiting. When I said that the homophile movement did not defend those of us who were in the bars, did not want to be associated with those of us in the bars, I'm not just criticizing like a Monday morning quarterback. It's the reason that Stonewall exploded. Those from below were nose to nose with the state. We knew at any moment in the bars that the cops could come through the door at any time. And just to get a job, just to get an apartment, just to use the toilet in public, just to walk down the street was a battle. It was no accident that Stonewall exploded from those who were the most oppressed. Stonewall was mostly fueled, that uprising, by those youth who lived in the little vest pocket park across the street, who could not afford to get into the bar with those watered-down, expensive drinks. They were black youth, Latina youth, white youth. They were homeless. Many were sex workers. They pooled their money just to be able to have one hotel room that they could share. And when the police raided that night and the government agents were there demanding the draft cards of everyone and dunking the heads of the drag queens into buckets of water and smearing the makeup on their faces and mocking them as limp-wristed sissies and reminding them that the sentence would be carried out that night in the backseat of a police cruiser or on the cold cement floor of a precinct cell, those who were being rounded up struggled and fought back, and so did the youth in the street. And they surrounded the police, and they began to throw their precious pocket change and pebbles and bottle caps and anything they could find, and the police began to retreat, not just because of a hail of tiny projectiles, but the youth that night taught the police that a stiletto-high heel in the hands of an enraged transgender youth is a formidable weapon against police brutality. And where did the youth get inspired that night? The battles that were going on all over the city, all over the country. Black power, the American Indian movement, the organizing of the Chicano farm workers in the fields, the young lords who were the Puerto Rican revolutionary youth, the militant Asian youth, students, the anti-Vietnam War movement, and women's liberation. That night, the youth were so ferocious that the police actually retreated back in the Stonewall bar and barricaded themselves inside, and someone had the foresight to cut the electric and power lines and phone lines so they were in there in the dark without backup. And this crowd, these were people whose bodies still bore the wounds from their arrests, who knew their oppressors by name and by face, and they rocked a parking meter and uprooted it from a concrete sidewalk to use as a battering ram to get in that bar at those police. They used lighter fluid and tried to burn the damn bar down. There were struggles going on in that city for open admissions at the school. The Columbia University had displaced people of Harlem, set up an apartheid fence around the school to keep it all lily white. And the students carried out an armed occupation, students of many nationalities, took over the campus and opened it up and called it Harlem U and said, everybody's coming to school for free now. Now the schools in the U.S. are being resegregated, not by grade point average, but by the elimination of financial aid and by hiking up soaring tuition costs to the point where nobody can afford it. But those were the struggles that won women's studies, that won Black and Chicano studies, that won Native studies. Those weren't gifts from the university administration. They were hard won from the movement from below. When women's liberation began to really take off, people like myself were not welcomed by many in the women's movement. And again, I don't say this to tear down the women's movement, but to make it stronger today. Movements are like the individuals, those of us who make up movements. We make mistakes. We only know what we know. When it's not conscious, it's still unconscious. There are a lot of currents in a movement. It's like a white-capped river. And which current is in the ascendancy, which current has the power and the forward thrust, will determine the politics of that movement. I want to raise one lesson that I think is applicable today. And that was not anything that those in the women's movement at the time did to be cruel or vicious or anything else. It was just the opposite. It was an important social experiment. Because women's liberation for the first time was, first of all, creating the word woman with pride. I mean, all the words that I grew up with, for those of us who were female, were not words that we would want to use about ourselves. But it also was a movement that showed the different socialization of those who were born female and male. And that was an important contribution because people did not even admit that women were oppressed. It's like, oh, honey, why? Because some guy opens a door for you, big deal. There was a ridiculing of the institutionalization of oppression and the way the economy profited from it and the way it pitted people against each other. And also, the women's movement, and again, I'm speaking in a general way when I say the women's movement, but those of us who have been in late-night meetings hammering out the language on press releases know that movements don't speak with one voice. But this was a widespread attempt to show how steeped concepts of femininity and masculinity were in poisonous attitudes. And that was a contribution, too. But the solution that many tried, and it was a significant social experiment to try, was to see, could humankind, not just women, but humankind be liberated by suppressing or doing away with femininity and masculinity and creating a kind of androgyny that would liberate people from the poisonous concepts that were so imbued in these gender expressions. Now, first of all, those of us who were butch were considered to be part of the patriarchy. And those who loved us were considered to be have no consciousness and be sleeping with the enemy. It was a vulgarization, but again, like I said, what we don't know, we don't know. And what is not conscious yet is still unconscious. And you know, androgyny is very liberating if you are androgynous. But if those of us who had been gang raped and beaten and institutionalized and humiliated and hounded and harassed and could not find a job and could not get medical care and were not safe walking down the street, did not change our gender expression, why would be? Because people in the movement said the way we were wasn't right. We wanted a movement that didn't just tolerate us, but needed us. And the movement did need us. And that's an important thing to remember. I believe that there are two very important tasks that still need to be done from that experiment. And one is to defend everybody's right to freedom of gender expression without criticism, without judgment, because it is not my tie that is oppressing you. It is not your wingtip rogues or your lipstick that is oppressing me. Part of the gift of second wave women's liberation to the consciousness of all was the understanding that this was an institutionalized mechanism of oppression in the economy and the society as a whole. And everyone is needed to fight that. And everyone has to feel that this is our movement and we're bringing something to it that is unique and precious. And the second task, and this is the other wing of this bird, is a thoroughgoing analysis of the attitudes that have been imbued in these gender expressions and getting rid of every damn one of them. This concept that masculinity is everything positive and femininity, therefore, is everything negative has to be done away with, including in our own movements. Where I hear part of the reason I wrote Stone Butch Blues was when I heard, you know, young women say, oh, you know, oh, she's so late, she's my femme. Well, you know how femmes are. I don't want to hear it.
Thank you.
You know, we shoot ourselves in the foot. If you want to defend femininity, if you want to defend femininity as being, or masculinity, let's say, as being the ability to create bookshelves that don't wobble and use power tools and change the oil on the car, well, then I am high femme. Anti-femme attitudes towards women and men are poison. They are a distillation of misogyny. And they are it's an enemy way of thinking for us all. And I, although I will claim being a masculine female for as long as it is an outlaw status, also don't want to essentialize for myself the concepts of masculinity and femininity. I think, you know, imagine only having two words to describe all of us. You know, which are you? Which are you, feminine or masculine? I mean, it's to me as though you took all of meteorological science and reduced it all to hot and cold. And who the hell would turn on television to see what the weather was going to be if they said it's going to be cold and cold and cold and cold and then it's going to be hot? How would you dress? I think of our gender expression as what each of us fashion from the social bolt of cloth that we are issued. I don't like to think about gender in terms of sharps and flats, but as the individual symphony from notes that we each make on a socially recognized tonal scale. And the reason I think this is so important to raise today is because I hear the argument that being gender queer is more revolutionary than to be a trans man or a trans woman. And you know what? Every time I hear somebody say that transsexual men and women are upholding the binary, I look at them and it's somebody who's male or female identified. And I think, don't drag us gender queers into your transsexual bashing. The fact is that it is an ahistorical approach to say that transsexual men and women are simply adapting to the rigid social roles for men and women today. And, you know, if we could just have a society where there was more equality and more flexibility with gender roles, then people wouldn't have to go to such extremes. And I think, wow, now there's some solidarity. I want to build a world so equitable that people like you won't exist. One of the things I did with Transgender Warriors was to go back and find every continent, thousands and thousands of years, written evidence and people's sacred stories. And you can find that what the dominant Western attitude today would refer to as sex and gender and sexuality, while it can't be applied, sex and gender and sexuality have been expressed differently in different historical periods and regions and nationalities and classes. The fact is that there's always been wide diversity in the human population. Gay American Indians in the U.S. published a book called Living the Spirit, And in the back of this book, they found the language and the words from 130 Native nations on the North American continent that had what they referred to as alternative sex/gender roles. These were pre-class societies. These were not the same societies. These are the societies that the armies of colonialism and imperialism go in and carry out a cultural genocide, a historical genocide, and are then free to say, and the way it is now is the way it has always been. So I come back to where I began, that I believe that the importance is so great to us, not only in the women's liberation movement, but in the movements for liberation, to deepen our understanding of the connections between racism and national oppression and the marginalization of people based on lack of accessibility and sex and gender expression and sexuality. And our movement today, no matter where we are, is taking place in the context of this U.S.-led war for empire. We need to be able to build diverse and powerful coalitions. But I believe they need to be united fronts, meaning that we can unite across many differences on a principled agreement, but it doesn't mean that unity means we have to leave all of who we are at the door. We don't need a movement that tolerates difference. We need a movement that is enriched by it, that does not say unity means that all women face the same oppression. That is not a contribution for unity and solidarity. We need to be able to appreciate the fact that all women don't share the same experience. And therefore, let's understand not only our difference, the different oppressions, because that's what the Stonewall Rebellion was. It was people who did not face a common oppression, who did not have the same experiences or degrees of oppression based on their leaving home in the morning, if they had a home to leave, but who made history when they united shoulder to shoulder against a common enemy. I want to bring the struggle of women to every movement, and I want to bring every struggle to women's liberation. I have heard the argument from some leftists in the U.S. that, well, you know, you can't really end the oppression of women under capitalism. I think, thank you. I knew that. But here's my question to you. How do you think you will build unity in the class struggle if you don't fight oppression? And if we're not, as Frederick Douglass said, trying to be the best fighters against each other's oppression as the glue for that coalition. Now, when it comes to war, and I hear Laura Bush get on the radio and use the words women's liberation, it's time to sweat. It's time to get together and talk. But that's exactly what happened before the U.S. invaded Afghanistan. The U.S. used the 9/11 crisis, but it was a pretext, because in fact, in the summer, they had already broken with the Taliban because the Unocal pipeline coming from Central Asia through Afghanistan wasn't going the way with negotiations that they wanted it done. So all of a sudden, they said, the Taliban is not kind to women. Well, they ought to know that. Washington helped put them into power. In fact, there were some leading white second wave feminists who signed open public letters calling for the U.S. to invade Afghanistan and liberate the women there. Well, where were they? Where were they when the Afghan people were making a revolution against feudalism? And the U.S. was arming the same forces that today it's referring to as terrorists in order to drown that revolution in blood, a revolution that abolished the bride price, that liberated women from feudalism in which women did not have names, that found leadership positions for women in education and jobs. Where was the women's movement when this revolution could have pushed things forward? It was hands off, because when the U.S. began arming the feudal landlords and their troops to go in and drown this revolution in blood, as in counter-revolutionary blood, the Afghan government called upon the Soviet Union to help defend them. And the U.S. said, well, the Soviet Union came in first, so now we got to go in. And the movement said, okay. Women's liberation and Afghanistan, women's liberation and Iraq, these are things that we have to be able to learn as lessons, because whenever a war is being planned or executed, they never say, come join our armies, go fight and die in order to enslave people around the world. Let's turn the clock back on history. Give your life, kill or be killed for big oil and Unocal and the banks and Halliburton. Instead, it's always as though the Pentagon and all the armies it drags in its tow are the great forces of liberation, just a Meals on Wheels, a humanitarian effort. Today in the U.S., there's a domestic war going on as well. And those who saw the aftermath of Katrina know that this was a shooting war. It was a shooting war, a racist war, which has created yet another diaspora in the Deep South of African Americans, and also of undocumented Latino workers whose names are just not there. Now, when they talk about rebuilding this city, they're talking about rebuilding it for rich whites, not for the people who live there. Today, in the U.S., universities, in many, more than 50% of some classes are being taught by people who have no benefits. Many people are working temp jobs, two or three, no health care. Every social and economic issue that we face in the U.S. today is tied to this war. Women's rights? Who will we turn to? The Pentagon, where we've just learned that there's been a systematic hiding of the fact that women GIs at night in 120 degree heat were not drinking water, died of dehydration because they feared being raped, going to the latrines, and the Pentagon higher-ups have covered this up. Money for breast cancer research, money for AIDS treatment, youth, jobs. Youth are being told, we've got a job for you. You just sign here. You can start right away. Social services, daycare, all of it's tied to the war. And lesbian, gay, bi rights, trans rights, the military, the biggest employer in the U.S., this public employer, you know, this equal opportunity employer, right? Don't ask, don't tell. They're carrying out a war of terror against their own ranks as well, in which soldiers are taught to bayonet the enemy using anti-gay epithets, anti-trans epithets, anti-woman slurs. And you know, during the first Gulf War, they lifted, the generals and admirals lifted the don't ask, don't tell. It was okay to be a lesbian, gay, bi, or trans GI until the invasion was over, and then they were all summarily discharged without any benefits. Those who are going over there and dying, we're being told in the U.S., you have to support them now. You have to support their mission. We say, no, that's your mission. The only people who support the troops are the ones, those of us who are saying, bring them home now. And we support the Iraqi right to resist being occupied and bombed and their infrastructure being dismantled and their resources being stolen. It is the resistance of the Iraqi people that is keeping all that wealth from being sucked out and is fighting against this huge, mega powerful army and cannot be broken by the shock and awe. And speaking of shock and awe, I want to stand in solidarity tonight, shoulder to shoulder with my Muslim sisters and brothers against this attack on Islam. This is not just a cartoon. That's a degrading of the issue of what this is really about. The so-called war on terror, the occupation of Afghanistan and Iraq, the menacing of Iran and Syria, the use of sex and gender humiliation and rape against prisoners in Abu Ghraib, the military interrogators reportedly flushing the Quran down the toilet in front of Muslim prisoners, the roundup of Arab and Muslim and South Asian people in the U.S., the mass disappearings. I stand with Muslim people from the Middle East to Asia to Africa to North America to say this is part of the racist salvos, the racist propaganda to try to justify the war on terror. I also hope that we can revitalize the left wing of women's liberation. We need to revive red feminism. Internationally known feminist theorist Chandra Talpati Mohanty, 2 decades ago, wrote a classic essay entitled Under Western Eyes, in which she challenged Western feminism to deepen its analysis of anti-colonialism, of anti-imperialism. And when she revisited this essay in her most recent book, Feminism Without Borders, she challenged Western feminism to deepen its anti-capitalist struggle. But to do so in the U.S., the citadel of anti-communism, means that the movement has to be able to withstand red baiting. And that's the last of these weapons I'd like to talk about tonight. I remember when I went to Faneuil Hall recently, I was walking around the way I did tonight nervously before a talk, and I saw a little plaque, and it said, Frederick Douglass spoke here, gave a very controversial speech. Now, what do you think was so controversial about that speech? He talked about abolishing slavery. Now, slavery is not the dominant social economic system. So now everybody, except maybe, I don't know, John Ashcroft or somebody, is against slavery, at least lip service. But the idea that all of what we have created through our labor historically, socially, should belong to a couple of people, a handful of families like the Bill Gates, to talk about abolishing that, now that's too controversial. That you can't even raise the word capitalism in the U.S. without all the air getting sucked out of the room. So, I don't think I like where this is going. It's the end of history, we're told. This is it. This is it. This terrible gap between wealth and poverty, where so many of the world's people are living on less than a dollar a day while 200 families own the lion's share. This is it. This is the highest form of social and economic organization to which we should aspire. But it's meant to keep us from even asking, is it possible that those of us who do the work of the world every day collectively and are never asked how it should be run could in fact take it over and run it to meet human needs, and not just human needs, but human wants and desires, not just to give people equally, because equal isn't equal, but to provide to people according to their need and to take and enrich society from people's abilities? Well, that's just too controversial. That's just too subversive. Now, there are some to the right of revolutionaries in the movement who would be not that unhappy if communists and other revolutionaries got driven out of the movement because they're political opponents and they think, well, I wouldn't mind, they're kind of a thorn in the side, you know. Maybe if the establishment just got rid of them, then we'd be the leaders. But that's not how it works. Once you sit back, even if you're anti-communist, and let people who are communist or even perceived to be get red-baited, then you become the left. And every time you ask for a quarter, you're going to get, what's the matter with you? Are you a communist? And then you'll get pushed back. The movement will be dismantled. A healthy, vibrant, dynamic movement has a strong left wing. History today is searching for the Sojourner Truths and the Harriet Tubmans, the Chang Chings and the Madam Bins and the Rosa Luxemburgs those who saw economic repressive systems that claimed to last forever, and yet they had the vision to be able to see what was possible and what had to be fought for, even when there weren't mass movements in the streets. Today, there is a new leadership of revolutionary women around the world, from the takeover of the oil facilities by women in Nigeria, to the Bolivian women who are part of the, to the Venezuelan women who are part of the Bolivian revolution, the indigenous women and other women who are organizing as grassroots. We get told, just wait till the next election if you want change, or go court a politician. Have you lobbied lately? That's the way to change things. Work within the system. Do it incrementally. And you know, if you don't know, for example, what happened in the 1950s to lift up that moderate demand of the homophile movement, then it could make it seem in a reactionary period that that's the way forward. It's just hat in hand, asking politely, give a yard, get an inch. But the fact is, as Frederick Douglass said, that power concedes nothing without a struggle. Never has, never will. They tell us wait for a great white man or a great white woman on a big white horse, and they'll come and change everything and save the day. But it's meant to keep us from the real truth that was summed up so succinctly and so eloquently by the late black poet June Jordan. She wrote, "We are the ones we have been waiting for." Thank you.